Chapter 9. Character of Captain Cook. Effects of his voyages. Testimonies of applause. Commemorations of his services. Regard paid to his family. Conclusion. From the relation that has been given of Captain Cook's course of life, and of the important events in which he was engaged, my readers cannot be strangers to his general character. This, therefore, might be left to be collected from his actions, which are the best exhibitions of the great qualities of his mind. But, perhaps, were I not to endeavor to afford a summary view of him in these respects, I might be thought to fail in that duty which I owe to the public on the present occasion. It cannot, I think, be denied that genius belonged to Captain Cook in an eminent degree. By genius, I do not here understand imagination merely, or that power of culling the flowers of fancy which poetry delights in, but an inventive mind, a mind full of resources, and which, by its own native vigor, can suggest noble objects of pursuit and the most effectual methods of attaining them. This faculty was possessed by our navigator in its full energy, as is evident from the uncommon sagacity and penetration which he discovered in a vast variety of critical and difficult situations. To genius Captain Cook added application, without which nothing very valuable or permanent can be accomplished, even by the brightest capacity. For an unremitting attention to whatever related to his profession, he was distinguished in early life. In every affair that was undertaken by him, his assiduity was without interruption and without abatement. Wherever he came, he suffered nothing which was fit for a seaman to know or to practice, to pass unnoticed, or to escape his diligence. The genius and application of Captain Cook were followed by a large extent of knowledge, a knowledge which, besides a consummate acquaintance with navigation, comprehended a number of other sciences. In this respect, the ardor of his mind rose above the disadvantages of a very confined education. His progress in the different branches of the mathematics, and particularly in astronomy, became so eminent that, at length, he was able to take the lead in making the necessary observations of this kind in the course of his voyages. He attained likewise to such a degree of proficiency in general learning and the art of composition as to be able to express himself with a manly clearness and propriety, and to become respectable as the narrator, as well as the performer, of great actions. Another thing, strikingly conspicuous in Captain Cook, was the perseverance with which he pursued the noble objects to which his life was devoted. This, indeed, was a most distinguished feature in his character. In this he scarcely ever had an equal, and never a superior. Nothing could divert him from the points he aimed at, and he persisted in the prosecution of them, through difficulties and obstructions, which would have deterred minds of very considerable strength and firmness. What enabled him to persevere in all his mighty undertakings was the invincible fortitude of his spirits. Of this, instances without number occur in the accounts of his expeditions, two of which I shall take the liberty of retailing to the attention of my readers. The first is the undaunted magnanimity with which he prosecuted his discoveries along the whole southeast coast of New Holland. Surrounded as he was with the greatest possible dangers, arising from the perpetual succession of rocks, shoals, and breakers, and having a ship that was almost shaken to pieces by repeated perils, his vigorous mind had a regard to nothing but what he thought was required of him by his duty to the public. It will not be easy to find, in the history of navigation, a parallel example of courageous exertion. The other circumstance I would refer to is the boldness with which, in his second voyage, after he left the Cape of Good Hope, he pushed forward into unknown seas, and penetrated through innumerable mountains and islands of ice, in the search of a southern continent. It was like launching into chaos. All was obscurity, all was darkness before him, and no event can be compared with it, excepting the sailing of Magellan's from the straits which bear his name into the Pacific Ocean. The fortitude of Captain Cook, being founded upon reason and not upon instinct, was not an impetuous valor, but accompanied with complete self-possession. He was master of himself on every trying occasion, and seemed to be the more calm and collected, the greater was the exigence of the case. In the most perilous situations, when our commander had given the proper directions concerning what was to be done, while he went to rest, he could sleep, during the hours he had allotted to himself, with perfect composure and soundness. Nothing could be a surer indication of an elevated mind, of a mind that was entirely satisfied with itself, and the measures it had taken. To all these great qualities Captain Cook added the most amiable virtues, that it was impossible for anyone to excel him in humanity, is apparent from his treatment of his men through all his voyages, and from his behavior to the natives of the countries which were discovered by him. The health, the convenience, and, as far as it could be admitted, the enjoyment of the seamen, were the constant objects of his attention, and he was anxiously solicitous to ameliorate the condition of the inhabitants of the several islands and places which he visited. With regard to their thieveries, he candidly apologized for, and overlooked many offenses which others would have sharply punished, and when he was laid under an indispensable necessity of proceeding to any acts of severity, he never exerted them without feeling much reluctance and concern. In the private relations of life, Captain Cook was entitled to high commendation. He was excellent as a husband and a father, and sincere and steady in his friendships, and to this, it may be added, that he possessed that general sobriety and virtue of character, which will always be found to constitute the best security and ornament of every other moral qualification. With the greatest benevolence and humanity of disposition, Captain Cook was occasionally subject to a hastiness of temper. This, which has been exaggerated by the few, and they are indeed few, who are unfavorable to his memory, is acknowledged by his friends. It is mentioned both by Captain King and Mr. Samwell, in their delineations of his character. Mr. Haley, in one of his poems, calls him the mild Cook. But, perhaps, that is not the happiest epithet which could have been applied to him. Mere mildness can scarcely be considered as the most prominent and distinctive feature in the mind of a man whose powers of understanding and of action were so strong and elevated, who had such immense difficulties to struggle with, and who must frequently have been called to the firmest exertions of authority and command. Lastly, Captain Cook was distinguished by a property which is almost universally the concomitant of truly great men, and that is, a simplicity of manners. In conversation he was unaffected and unassuming, rather backward in pushing discourse, but obliging and communicative in his answers to those who addressed him for the purposes of information. It was not possible that, in a mind constituted like his, such a paltry quality as vanity could find an existence. In this imperfect delineation of Captain Cook's character, I have spoken of him in a manner which is fully justified by the whole course of his life and actions, and which is perfectly agreeable to the sentiments of those who were the most nearly connected with him in the habits of intimacy and friendship. The pictures which some of them have drawn of him, though they have already been presented to the public, cannot here with propriety be omitted. Captain King has expressed himself concerning him in the following terms: the constitution of his body was robust, inured to labor, and capable of undergoing the severest hardships. His stomach bore, without difficulty, the coarsest and most ungrateful food. Great was the indifference with which he submitted to every kind of self-denial. The qualities of his mind were of the same hearty, vigorous kind with those of his body. His understanding was strong and perspicacious. his judgment, in whatever related to the services he was engaged in, quick and sure. His designs were bold and manly, and both in the conception, and in the mode of execution, bore evident marks of a great original genius. His courage was cool and determined, and accompanied with an admirable presence of mind in the moment of danger. His temper might perhaps have been justly blamed, as subject to hastiness and passion, had not these been disarmed by a disposition the most benevolent and humane. Such were the outlines of Captain Cook's character, but its most distinguishing feature was that unremitting perseverance in the pursuit of his object, which was not only superior to the opposition of dangers and the pressure of hardships, but even exempt from the want of ordinary relaxation. During the long and tedious voyages in which he was engaged, his eagerness and activity were never in the least abated. No incidental temptation could detain him for a moment, even those intervals of recreation, which sometimes unavoidably occurred, and were looked for by us with a longing that persons who have experienced the fatigues of service will readily excuse, were submitted to by him with a certain impatience, whenever they could not be employed in making a farther provision for the more effectual prosecution of his designs. The character of Captain Cook, says Mr. Samwell, will be best exemplified by the services he has performed, which are universally known, and have ranked his name above that of any navigator of ancient or of modern times. Nature had endowed him with a mind vigorous and comprehensive, which in his riper years he had cultivated with care and industry. His general knowledge was extensive and various, in that of his own profession he was unequaled. With a clear judgment, strong masculine sense, and the most determined resolution, with a genius peculiarly turned for enterprise, he pursued his object with unshaken perseverance, vigilant and active in an eminent degree, cool and intrepid among dangers, patient and firm under difficulties and distress, fertile in expedients, great and original in all his designs, active and resolved in carrying them into execution. These qualities rendered him the animating spirit of the expedition. In every situation he stood unrivaled and alone. On him all eyes were turned. He was our leading star, which, at its setting, left us involved in darkness and despair. His constitution was strong, his mode of living temperate. He was a modest man, and rather bashful, of an agreeable lively conversation, sensible and intelligent. In his temper he was somewhat hasty, but of a disposition the most friendly, benevolent, and humane. His person was about 6 feet high, and, though a good-looking man, he was plain both in address and appearance. His head was small, his hair, which was a dark brown, he wore tied behind. His face was full of expression, his nose exceedingly well shaped, his eyes, which were small, and of a brown cast, were quick and piercing, his eyebrows prominent, which gave his countenance altogether an air of austerity. He was beloved by his people, who looked up to him, as to a father, and obeyed his commands with alacrity. The confidence we placed in him was unremitting. Our admiration of his great talents, unbounded. Our esteem for his good qualities, affectionate and sincere. He was remarkably distinguished for the activity of his mind. It was that which enabled him to pay an unwearied attention to every object of the service. The strict economy he observed in the expenditure of the ship's stores, and the unremitting care he employed for the preservation of the health of his people, were the causes that enabled him to prosecute discoveries in remote parts of the globe for such a length of time as had been deemed impracticable by former navigators. The method he discovered for preserving the health of seamen in long voyages will transmit his name to posterity as the friend and benefactor of mankind. The success which attended it afforded this truly great man more satisfaction than the distinguished fame that attended his discoveries. England has been unanimous in her tribute of applause to his virtues, and all Europe has borne testimony to his merit. There is hardly a corner of the earth, however remote and savage, that will not long remember his benevolence and humanity. The grateful Indian, in time to come, pointing to the herds grazing his fertile plains, will relate to his children how the first stock of them was introduced into the country, and the name of Cook will be remembered among those benign spirits, whom they worship as the source of every good, and the fountain of every blessing. At the conclusion of the introduction to the voyage to the Pacific Ocean is an eulogium on Captain Cook, drawn up by one of his own profession, of whom it is said that he is not more distinguished by the elevation of rank than by the dignity of private virtues. Though this excellent eulogium must be known to many, and perhaps to most of my readers, they will not be displeased at having the greater part of it brought to their recollection. Captain James Cook possessed, says the writer, in an eminent degree, all the qualifications requisite for his profession and great undertakings, together with the amiable and worthy qualities of the best men. Cool and deliberate in judging, sagacious in determining, active in executing, steady and persevering in enterprising, from vigilance and unremitting caution, unsubdued by labor, difficulties, and disappointments, fertile in expedients, never wanting presence of mind, always possessing himself, and the full use of a sound understanding. Mild, just, but exact in discipline, he was a father to his people, who were attached to him from affection, and obedient from confidence. His knowledge, his experience, his sagacity, rendered him so entirely master of his subject, that the greatest obstacles were surmounted, and the most dangerous navigations became easy, and almost safe, under his direction. By his benevolent and unabating attention to the welfare of his ship's company, he discovered and introduced a system for the preservation of the health of seamen in long voyages, which has proved wonderfully efficacious. The death of this eminent and valuable man was a loss to mankind in general, and particularly to be deplored by every nation that respects useful accomplishments, that honors science, and loves the benevolent and amiable affections of the heart. It is still more to be deplored by this country, which may justly boast of having produced a man hitherto unequaled for nautical talents, and that sorrow is farther aggravated by the reflection that his country was deprived of this ornament by the enmity of a people, from whom, indeed, it might have been dreaded, but from whom it was not deserved. For, actuated always by the most attentive care and tender compassion for the savages in general, this excellent man was ever assiduously endeavoring, by kind treatment, to dissipate their fears, and court their friendship, overlooking their thefts and treacheries, and frequently interposing, at the hazard of his life, to protect them from the sudden resentment of his own injured people. Traveler, contemplate, admire, revere, and emulate this great master in his profession, whose skill and labors have enlarged natural philosophy, have extended nautical science, and have disclosed the long-concealed and admirable arrangements of the Almighty to the formation of this globe, and, at the same time, the arrogance of mortals, in presuming to account, by their speculations, for the laws by which he was pleased to create it. It is now discovered, beyond all doubt, that the same great being who created the universe by his fiat, by the same ordained our earth, to keep a just poise, without a corresponding southern continent, and it does so. He stretches out the north over the empty place, and hangeth the earth upon nothing, Job XXVI. 7. If the arduous, but exact researches of this extraordinary man have not discovered a new world, they have discovered seas unnavigated and unknown before. They have made us acquainted with islands, people, and productions of which we had no conception. And if he has not been so fortunate as Americus, to give his name to a continent, his pretensions to such a distinction remain unrivaled, and he will be revered while there remains a page of his own modest account of his voyages, and as long as mariners and geographers shall be instructed, by his new map of the southern hemisphere, to trace the various courses and discoveries he has made. If public services merit public acknowledgments, if the man, who adorned and raised the fame of his country, is deserving of honors, then Captain Cook deserves to have a monument raised to his memory by a generous and grateful nation. Urchidus iberimum elementum est honos. Val. Maximus, lib. I. Cap. 6. Apostrophe, the last character I shall here insert of Captain Cook comes from a learned writer, who, in consequence of some disagreements which are understood to have subsisted between him and our great navigator, cannot be suspected of intending to celebrate him in the language of flattery. Dr. Reinhold Forster, having given a short account of the captain's death, adds as follows, "Thus fell this truly glorious and justly admired navigator. If we consider his extreme abilities both natural and acquired, the firmness and constancy of his mind, his truly paternal care for the crew interested to him, the amiable manner with which he knew how to gain the friendship of all the savage and uncultivated nations, and even his conduct towards his friends and acquaintance, we must acknowledge him to have been one of the greatest men of his age, and that reason justifies the tear which friendship pays to his memory." After such an encomium on Captain Cook, less regard may justly be paid to the deductions from it, which are added by Dr. Forster. What he hath said concerning the captain's temper seems to have received a tincture of exaggeration, from prejudice and personal animosity. And the doctor's insinuation, that our navigator obstructed Lieutenant Picquart's Gill's promotion, is, I have good reason to believe, wholly groundless. There is another error which must not pass unnoticed. Dr. Forster puts in his caveat against giving the name of Cook's Straits to the straits between Asia and America, discovered by Bering. But if the doctor had read the voyage to the Pacific Ocean, published by authority, he would have seen that there was no design of robbing Bering of the honor to which he was entitled. From a survey of Captain Cook's character, it is natural to extend our reflections to the effects of the several expeditions in which he was engaged. These, indeed, must have largely appeared in the general history of his life, and they have finally been displayed by Dr. Douglas in his admirable introduction to the voyage to the Pacific Ocean. Under the conduct of so able a guide, I shall subjoin a short view of the subject. It must, however, be observed that, with regard to the three principal consequences of our great navigator's transactions, I have nothing further to offer. These are, his having dispelled the illusion of a terra australis incognita, his demonstration of the impracticability of a northern passage from the Pacific to the Atlantic Ocean, and his having established a sure method of preserving the health of seamen in the longest voyages, and through every variety of latitude and climate. Concerning each of these capital objects, I have already so fully spoken, that it is not in my power to add to the impression of their importance, and of Captain Cook's merits in relation to them, which, I trust, is firmly fixed on the mind of every reader. It is justly remarked by Dr. Douglas that one great advantage accruing to the world from our late surveys of the globe is that they have confuted fanciful theories, too likely to give birth to impracticable undertakings. The ingenious reveries of speculative philosophers, which have so long amused the learned and raised the most sanguine expectations, are now obliged to submit, perhaps with reluctance, to the sober dictates of truth and experience. Nor will it be only by discouraging future unprofitable searches that the late voyages will be of service to mankind, but also by lessening the dangers and distresses formerly experienced in those seas which are within the actual line of commerce and navigation. From the British discoveries, many commercial improvements may be expected to arise in our own times, but, in future ages, such improvements may be extended to a degree of which, at present, we have no conception. In the long chain of causes and effects, no one can tell how widely and beneficially the mutual intercourse of the various inhabitants of the earth may hereafter be carried on, in consequence of the means of facilitating it, which have been explored and pointed out by Captain Cook. The interests of science, as well as of commerce, stand highly indebted to this illustrious navigator. That a knowledge of the globe on which we live is a very desirable object, no one can call in question. This is an object which, while it is ardently pursued by the most enlightened philosophers, is sought for with avidity, even by those whose studies do not carry them beyond the lowest rudiments of learning. It need not be said, what gratification Captain Cook hath provided for the world in this respect. Before the voyages of the present reign took place, nearly half the surface of the earth was hidden in obscurity and confusion. From the discoveries of our navigator, geography has assumed a new face, and become, in a great measure, a new science, having attained to such a completion as to leave only some less important parts of the globe to be explored by future voyagers. 17, footnote 17, Lieutenant Roberts' admirable chart will set this matter in the strongest light. Happily for the advancement of knowledge, acquisitions cannot be obtained in any one branch without leading to acquisitions in other branches of equal and perhaps of superior consequence. New oceans cannot be traversed, or new countries visited, without presenting fresh objects of speculation and inquiry, and carrying the practice, as well as the theory, of philosophy to a higher degree of perfection. Nautical astronomy, in particular, was in its infancy when the late voyages were first undertaken. But, during the prosecution of them, and especially in Captain Cook's last expedition, even many of the petty officers could observe the distance of the moon from the sun, or a star, the most delicate of all observations, with sufficient accuracy. As for the officers of superior rank, they would have felt themselves ashamed to have it thought that they did not know how to observe for, and compute the time at sea. Though such a thing had, a little before, scarcely been heard of among seamen. Nay, first-rate philosophers had doubted the possibility of doing it with the exactness that could be wished. It must, however, be remembered that a large share of praise is due to the Board of Longitude for the proficiency of the gentlemen of the Navy in taking observations at sea. In consequence of the attention of that board to this important object, liberal rewards have been given to mathematicians for perfecting the lunar tables and facilitating calculations, and artists have been amply encouraged in the construction of instruments and watches, much more accurately and completely adapted to the purposes of navigation than formerly existed. It is needless to mention what a quantity of additional information has been gained with respect to the rise and times of the flowing of the tides, the direction and force of currents at sea, and the cause and nature of the polarity of the needle, and the theory of its variations. Natural knowledge has been increased by experiments on the effects of gravity in different and very distant places, and from Captain Cook's having penetrated so far into the Southern Ocean, it is now ascertained that the phenomenon, usually called the aurora borealis, is not peculiar to high northern latitudes, but belongs equally to all cold climates, whether they be north or south. Amidst the different branches of science that have been promoted by the late expeditions, there is none, perhaps, that stands so highly indebted to them as the science of botany. At least 1,200 new plants have been added to the known system, and large accessions of intelligence have accrued with regard to every other part of natural history. This point has already been evinced by the writings of Dr. Sparman, of the two Forsters, father and son, and of Mr. Pennant, And this point will illustriously be manifested when the great work of Sir Joseph Banks shall be accomplished and given to the world. It is not to the enlargement of natural knowledge only that the effects arising from Captain Cook's voyages are to be confined. Another important object of study has been opened by them, and that is the study of human nature in situations various, interesting, and uncommon. The islands visited in the center of the South Pacific Ocean, and the principal scenes of the operations of our discoverers, were untrodden ground. As the inhabitants, so far as could be observed, had continued from their original settlement unmixed with any different tribe, as they had been left entirely to their own powers for every art of life, and to their own remote traditions for every political or religious custom or institution, as they were uninformed by science and unimproved by education, they could not but afford many subjects of speculation to an inquisitive and philosophical mind. Hence may be collected a variety of important facts with respect to the state of man, with respect to his attainments and deficiences, his virtue and vices, his employments and diversions, his feelings, manners, and customs, in a certain period of society. Even the curiosities which have been brought from the discovered islands, and which enrich the British Museum, and the late Sir Ashton Lever's repository, may be considered as a valuable acquisition to this country, as supplying no small fund of information and entertainment. Few inquiries are more interesting than those which relate to the migrations of the various families, or tribes that have peopled the earth. It was known in general that the Asiatic nation, called Malayans, possessed, in former times, much the greatest trade in the Indies, and that they frequented, with their merchant ships, not only all the coasts of Asia, but ventured over even to the coasts of Africa, and particularly to the great island of Madagascar. But that, from Madagascar to the Marquesas and Easter Island, that is, nearly from the east side of Africa, till we approach towards the west side of America, a space including above half the circumference of the globe, the same nation of the Oriental world should have made their settlements, and founded colonies throughout almost every intermediate stage of this immense tract, in islands at amazing distances from the mother continent, and the natives of which were ignorant of each other's existences and historical fact, that, before Captain Cook's voyages, could be but very imperfectly known. He it is who hath discovered a vast number of new spots of land lurking in the bosom of the South Pacific Ocean, all the inhabitants of which display striking evidences of their having derived their descent from one common Asiatic original. Nor is this apparent solely from a similarity of customs and institutions, but is established by a pro, of which conveys irresistible conviction to the mind, and that is, the affinity of language. The collections that have been made of the words which are used in the widely diffused islands and countries that have lately been visited cannot fail, in the hands of such men as A. Bryant and A. Marsden, to throw much light on the origin of nations and the peopling of the globe. From Mr. Marsden, in particular, who has devoted his attention, time, and study to this curious subject, the literary world may hereafter expect to be highly instructed and entertained. There is another family of the earth, concerning which new information has been derived from the voyages of our British navigators. That the Esquimaux, who had hitherto only been found seated on the coasts of Labrador and Hudson's Bay, agreed with the Greenlanders in every circumstance of customs, manners, and language, which could demonstrate an original identity of nation, had already been ascertained. But that the same tribe now actually inhabit the islands and coasts on the west side of North America, opposite Kamchatka, was a discovery, the completion of which was reserved for Captain Cook. From his account it appears that these people have extended their migrations to Norton Sound, Unalashka, and Prince William Sound, that is, to nearly the distance of 1,500 leagues from their stations in Greenland and the coast of Labrador. Nor does this curious fact rest merely on the evidence arising from similitude of manners, for it stands confirmed by a table of words, exhibiting such an affinity of language as will remove every doubt from the mind of the most scrupulous inquirer. Other questions there are, of a very important nature, the solution of which will now be rendered more easy than hath heretofore been apprehended. From the full confirmation of the vicinity of the two continents of Asia and America, it can no longer be represented as ridiculous to believe that the former furnished inhabitants to the latter. By the facts recently discovered, a credibility is added to the Mosaic account of the peopling of the earth. That account will, I doubt not, stand the test of the most learned and rigorous investigation. Indeed, I have long been convinced, after the closest meditation of which I am capable, that sound philosophy and genuine revelation never militate against each other. The rational friends of religion are so far from dreading the spirit of inquiry, that they wish for nothing more than a candid, calm, and impartial examination of the subject according to all the lights which the improved reason and the enlarged science of man can afford. One great effect of the voyages made under the conduct of Captain Cook is their having excited a zeal for similar undertakings. Other princes and other nations are engaged in expeditions of navigation and discovery. By order of the French government, Mess, de La Perouse, and de Langle sailed from Brest, in August, 1785, in the frigates Bousole and Astrolube, on an enterprise, the express purpose of which was the improvement of geography, astronomy, natural history, and philosophy, and to collect accounts of customs and manners. For the more effectual prosecution of the design, several gentlemen were appointed to go out upon the voyage, who were known to excel in different departments of science and literature. Mr. Dagelet went as astronomer, M. de la Martiniere, P. Receiver, and M. de la Fresne, as naturalists, and the Chevalier de Lamennais and M. Monges, Jr., as natural philosophers. The officers of the Bousole were men of the best information, and the firmest resolution, and the crew contained a number of artificers in various kinds of mechanic employments. Marine watches, and other instruments, were provided, and M. Dagelet was particularly directed to make observations with M. Condamine's invariable pendulum, to determine the differences in gravity, and to ascertain the true proportion of the equatorial to the polar diameter of the earth. From some accounts which have already been received of these voyages, it appears that they have explored the coast of California, have adjusted the situation of more than 50 places, almost wholly unknown, and have visited Oahu and the rest of the Sandwich Islands. When the expedition shall be completed, the whole result of it will doubtless be laid before the public. 18, footnote 18, an account of this voyage during the year 1785, 1786, 1787, and 1788, has been published in France, from papers transmitted at different times by La Perouse, but nothing since the year 1788 has been received relative to the progress of the voyage, or the fate of the voyagers, who are all supposed to have perished by shipwreck. Although Captain Cook has made such vast discoveries in the Northern Ocean, on and between the east of Asia and the west coast of America, Mr. Cox has well shown that there is still room for a farther investigation of that part of the world. Accordingly, the object has been taken up by the Empress of Russia, who has committed the conduct of the enterprise to Captain Billings, an Englishman in Her Majesty's service. As Captain Billings was with Captain Cook in his last voyage, he may reasonably be supposed to be properly qualified for the business he has undertaken. The design, with the execution of which he is entrusted, appears to be very extensive and important, and, if it should be crowned with success, cannot fail of making considerable additions to the knowledge of geography and navigation. There is one event at home, which has evidently resulted from Captain Cook's discoveries, and which, therefore, must not be omitted. What I refer to is the settlement at Botany Bay. With the general policy of this measure, the present narrative is not any concern. The plan, I doubt not, has been adopted with the best intentions, after the maturest deliberation, and perhaps with consummate wisdom. One evident advantage arising from it is, that it will effectually prevent a number of unhappy wretches from returning to their former scenes of temptations and guilt, and may open to them the means of industrious subsistence and moral reformation. If it be wisely and prudently begun and conducted, who can tell what beneficial consequences may spring from it, in future ages? Immortal Rome is said to have risen from the refuse of mankind. While we are considering the advantages the discoverers have derived from the late navigations, a question naturally occurs, which is, what benefits have hence accrued to the discovered? It would be a source of the highest pleasure to be able to answer the question to complete satisfaction. But it must be acknowledged that the subject is not wholly free from doubts and difficulties. And these doubts and difficulties might be enlarged upon, and exaggerated, by an imagination which is rather disposed to contemplate, and represent the dark than the luminous aspect of human affairs. In one respect, Mr. Samwell has endeavored to shew, that the natives of the lately explored parts of the world, and especially so far as relates to the Sandwich Islands, were not injured by our people, and it was the constant solicitude and care of Captain Cook that evil might not be communicated in any one place to which he came. If he was universally successful, the good which, in various cases, he was instrumental in producing, will be reflected upon with the more peculiar satisfaction. There is an essential difference between the voyages that have lately been undertaken, and many which have been carried on in former times. None of my readers can be ignorant of the horrid cruelties that were exercised by the conquerors of Mexico and Peru, cruelties which can never be remembered without blushing for religion and human nature. But to undertake expeditions with a design of civilizing the world and ameliorating its condition is a noble object. The recesses of the globe were investigated by Captain Cook, not to enlarge private dominion, but to promote general knowledge. The new tribes of the earth were visited as friends, and an acquaintance with their existence was sought for, in order to bring them within the pale of the offices of humanity, and to relieve the wants of their imperfect state of society. Such were the benevolent views which our navigator was commissioned by His Majesty to carry into execution, and there is reason to hope that they will not be wholly unsuccessful. From the long-continued intercourse with the natives of the Friendly Society and Sandwich Islands, some rays of light must have darted on their infant minds. The uncommon objects which have been presented to their observation and excited their surprise will naturally tend to enlarge their stock of ideas and to furnish new materials for the exercise of their reasonable faculties. It is no small addition to their comforts of life and their immediate enjoyments that will be derived from the introduction of our useful animals and vegetables. And if the only benefit they should ever receive from the visits of the English should be the having obtained fresh means of subsistence, that must be considered as a great acquisition. But may not our hopes be extended to still nobler objects? The connection which has been opened with these remote inhabitants of the world is the first step toward their improvement, and consequences may flow from it which are far beyond our present conceptions. Perhaps our late voyages may be the means appointed by Providence of spreading, in due time, the blessings of civilization among the numerous tribes of the South Pacific Ocean, and preparing them for holding an honorable rank among the nations of the earth. There cannot be a more laudable attempt than that of endeavoring to rescue millions of our fellow creatures from that state of humiliation in which they now exist. Nothing can more essentially contribute to the attainment of this great end than a wise and rational introduction of the Christian religion, an introduction of it in its genuine simplicity, as holding out the worship of one God, inculcating the purest morality, and promising eternal life as the reward of obedience. These are views of things which are adapted to general comprehension, and calculated to produce the noblest effects. Considering the eminent abilities displayed by Captain Cook, and the mighty actions performed by him, it is not surprising that his memory should be held in the highest estimation, both at home and abroad. Perhaps, indeed, greater honor is paid to his name abroad than at home. Foreigners, I am informed, look up to him with an admiration which is not equaled in this country. A remarkable proof of it occurs in the eulogy of our navigator by Michelangelo Gianetti, which was read at the Royal Florentine Academy on the 9th of June, 1785, and published at Florence in the same year. Not having seen it, I am deprived of the power of doing justice to its merit. If I am not mistaken in my recollection, one of the French literary academies has proposed a prize for the best eulogium on Captain Cook, and there can be no doubt but that several candidates will appear upon the occasion and exert the whole force of their eloquence on so interesting a subject. To the applauses of our navigator, which have already been inserted, I cannot avoid adding some poetical testimonies concerning him. The first I shall produce is from a foreign poet, M. Lab Lysell. This gentleman has concluded his Les Jardins with an encomium on Captain Cook, of which the following lines are a translation. Ive, give me flowers, with garlands of renown those glorious exiles' brows my hands shall crown, who nobly sought on distant coasts to find, or thither bore those arts that bless mankind, the chief, brave Cook, or whom, to nature dear, with Britain, Gallia drops the pitying tear. To foreign climes and rude, where not before announced our vessels, but their cannons roar, far other gifts thy better mind decreed, the sheep, the heifer, and the stately steed, the plough, and all thy country's arts, the crimes atoning thus of earlier savage times. With peace each land thy bark was wont to hail, and tears and blessings fill at thy parting sail. Receive a stranger's praise, nor, Britain, thou forbid these wreaths to grace thy hero's brow, nor scorn the tribute of a foreign song, for virtue's sons to every land belong, and shall the Gallic muse disdain to pay the meed of worth, when Louis leads the way. But what availed, that twice thou daredst to try the frost-bound sea, and twice the burning sky, that by winds, waves, and every realm revered, safe, only safe, thy sacred vessel steered, that war for thee forgot its dire commands the world's great friend, bleeds by savage hands. There have not been wanting elegant writers of our own country, who have embraced with pleasure the opportunities that have offered of paying a tribute of praise to Captain Cook. The ingenious and amiable Miss Hannah More has lately seized an occasion of celebrating the humane intentions of the captain's discoveries. At those adventurous spirits, who explore through ocean's trackless wastes, the far-sought shore, whether of wealth insatiate, or of power, conquerors who waste, or ruffians who devour, at these possessed, O Cook, thy gentle mind, thy love of arts, thy love of humankind, at these pursued thy mild and liberal plan, discoverers had not been a curse to man. Then, blessed philanthropy, thy social hands had linked dissevered worlds in brothers' bands, careless, if color, or if clime divide, then loved and loving, man had lived, and died. Soon after the account arrived in England of Captain Cook's decease, two poems were published in celebration of his memory, one of which was an ode, by a Mr. Fitzgerald, of Gray's Inn. But the first, both in order of time and of merit, was an elegy, by Miss Seward, whose poetical talents have been displayed in many beautiful instances to the public. This lady, in the beginning of her poem, has admirably represented the principle of humanity by which the captain was actuated in his undertakings. He, who erewhile for Cook's illustrious brow plucked the green laurel and the oaken bough, hung the gay garlands on the trophy doors, and poured his fame along a thousand shores. Strike the slow death bell, weave the sacred verse, and strew the cypress o'er his honored hearse, and sad procession wander round the shrine, and weep immortal, whom ye sung divine. A first, what poor in spirit is dauntless, breast with scorn of danger, and inglorious rest, to quit imperial London's gorgeous plains, where, robed in thousand tints, bright pleasure reigns. What poor in spirit is dauntless breast, to brave the scorched equator, and th Antarctic wave. Climes, where fierce suns in cloudless ardors shine, and pour the dazzling deluge round the line. The realms of frost, where icy mountains rise, mid the pale summer of the polar skies. It was humanity, on coasts unknown, the shivering natives of the frozen zone, and the swart Indian, as he faintly strays where cancer reddens in the solar blaze, apostrophe she bade him seek. On each inclement shore plant the rich seeds of her exhaustless store, unite the savage hearts, and hostile hands, in the firm compact of her gentle bands. Strew her soft comforts o'er the barren plain, sing her sweet lays, and consecrate her fane. It was humanity. O nymph divine, I see thy light step print the burning line. There thy bright eye the dubious pilot guides, the faint oar struggling with the scalding tides on as thou lead'st the bold, the glorious prow, mild, and more mild, the sloping sunbeams glow. Now weak and pale the lessened lustres play, as round th horizon rolls the timid day. Barbed with the sleeted snow, the driving hail, rush the fierce arrows of the polar gale. And through the dim, unvaried, lingering hours, wide o'er the waves incumbent horror lours. Captain Cook's endeavors to serve the inhabitants of New Zealand, by the vegetables and animals he left among them, are thus described. Oh, these the hero leads his living store, and pours new wonders on th uncultured shore, the silky fleece, fair fruit, and golden grain. And future herds and harvests bless the plain, o'er the green soil his kids exulting play, and sounds his clarion loud the bird of day. The downy goose her ruffled bosom laves, trims her white wing, and wantons in the waves. Stern moves the bull along th affrighted shores, and countless nations tremble as he roars. I shall only add the pathetic and animated conclusion of this fine poem. Adah! Aloft on Albion's rocky steep, that frowns incumbent o'er the boiling deep, solicitous and sad, a softer form eyes the lone flood, and deprecates the storm. Ill-fated matron! For, alas! In vain thy eager glances wander o'er the main. 'Tis the vexed billows, that insurgent rave, their white foam silvers yonder distant wave. 'Tis not his sails, thy husband comes no more. His bones now whiten and accursed shore. Retire, for hark, the seagull shrieking soars, the lurid atmosphere portentous lours. Night's sullen spirit groans in every gale, and o'er the waters draws the darkling veil, sighs in thy hair, and chills thy throbbing breast, go wretched mourner. Weep thy griefs to rest. Et, though through life is lost each fond delight, though set thy earthly sun in dreary night, oh! Raise thy thoughts to yonder starry plain, and own thy sorrow selfish, weak, and vain, since, while Britannia, to his virtues just, twines the bright wreath, and rears th immortal bust, while on each wind of heaven his fame shall rise, an endless incense to the smiling skies, the attendant power, that bade his sails expand, and waft her blessings to each barren land. Now raptured bears him to th immortal plains, where mercy hails him with congenial strains, where soars, on joy's white plume, his spirit free, and angels choir him, while he waits for thee. Captain Cook's discoveries, among other effects, have opened new scenes for a poetical fancy to range in, and presented new images to the selection of genius and taste. The morals, in particular, of the inhabitants of the South Sea Islands, afford a fine subject for the exercise of a plaintive muse. Such a muse hath seized upon the subject, and, at the same time, has added another wreath to the memory of our navigator. I refer to a lady, who hath already, in many passages of her Peru, apostrophe in her ode on the peace. Apostrophe, and, above all, in her irregular fragment, apostrophe amply proved to the world that she possesses not only the talent of elegant and harmonious versification, but the spirit of true poetry. The poem, which I have now the pleasure of giving for the first time to the public, and which was written at my request, will be found in the appendix. It is somewhat remarkable that female poets have hitherto been the chief celebrators of Captain Cook in this country. Perhaps a subject which would furnish materials for as rich a production as Camon's Lusiad, and which would adorn the pen of a Haley or a Cowper, may hereafter call forth the genius of some poet of the stronger sex. The Royal Society of London could not lose such a member of their body as Captain Cook, without being anxious to honor his name and memory by a particular mark of respect. Accordingly, it was resolved to do this by a medal, and a voluntary subscription was opened for the purpose. To such of the fellows of the society as subscribed 20 guineas, a gold medal was appropriated. Silver medals were assigned to those who contributed a smaller sum, and to each of the other members one in bronze was given. The subscribers of 20 guineas were Sir Joseph Banks, President, the Prince of Ansbach, the Duke of Montague, Lord Mulgrave and Mr. Cavendish, Mr. Peachey, Mr. Perrin, Mr. Poley, and Mr. Shuttleworth. Many designs, as might be expected, were proposed on the occasion. The medal which was actually struck contains, on one side, the head of Captain Cook in profile, and round it, Jack Cook, a senior investigator of Ceramus, and on the exerg, Reg Sock Lond Sociusuo. On the reverse, is a representation of Britannia holding a globe. Round her is inscribed Nil intentitum nostri liquir, and on the exerg, Auspicius Georgia III. Of the gold medals which were struck on this occasion, one was presented to His Majesty, another to the Queen, and a third to the Prince of Wales. Two were sent abroad, the first to the French King on account of the protection he had granted to the ships under the command of Captain Cook, and a second to the Empress of Russia, in whose dominions the same ships had been received, and treated with every degree of friendship and kindness. Both these presents were highly acceptable to the great personages to whom they were transmitted. The French King expressed his satisfaction in a very handsome letter to the Royal Society, signed by himself, and undersigned by the Marquis de Vergennes, and the Empress of Russia commissioned Count Osterman, to signify to Mr. Fitzherbert the sense she entertained of the value of the present, and that as he had caused it to be forthwith deposited in the Museum of the Imperial Academy of Sciences. As a farther testimony of the pleasure she derived from it, the Empress presented to the Royal Society a large and beautiful gold medal, containing on one side the effigies of herself, and on the reverse a representation of the statue of Peter the Great. After the general assignment of the medals, which took place in the spring of the year 1784, there being a surplus of money still remaining, the President and Council resolved that an additional number should be struck off in gold, to be disposed of as presents to Mrs. Cook, the Earl of Sandwich, Dr. Benjamin Franklin, Dr. Cook, Provost of King's College, Cambridge, and Mr. Planta. About the same time it was agreed that Mr. Aubert should be allowed to have a gold medal of Captain Cook, on his paying for the gold, and the expense of striking it, in consideration of his intention to present it to the King of Poland. During the two visits of the Resolution and Discovery at Kamchatka, it was from Colonel Bem, the commandant of that province, that the ships, and the officers and men belonging to them, had received every kind of assistance which it was in his power to bestow. His liberal and hospitable behavior to the English navigators is related at large in Captain King's voyage. Such was the sense entertained of it by the lords of the Admiralty, that they determined to make a present to the colonel, of a magnificent piece of plate, with an inscription expressive of his humane and generous disposition and conduct. The elegant pen of Dr. Cook was employed in drawing up the inscription, which, after it had been subjected to the opinion and correction of some gentlemen of the first eminence in classical taste, was as follows. Viro egregio mango de Bem, q who I am, Paratrosis Augustissimi Catharina Auspicius, summiconim I benignitate, Siva, quibus priorit, Kamchatki Latora, Navibus Nautis Britannicis, Hospita Prebuit, Eisk, Interminus, Si Qui Essent Imperio Russico Frustra, Explorandus, Malamota Perpesos, Iterata, Vice Expit, Refesit, Recrevit, A Comitu Ami Cumulate Octos Dimisit, Reinavalis Britannici Septumvirian Aliquum Benevolenti Tam Insignis Memoriam, Amicissimo, Gratissimiconimo, Suo, Patriac Nomine, D.D. D. M.D.C.C. LXXXI. Apostrophe, Sir Hugh Pauliser, who through life manifested an invariable regard and friendship for Captain Cook, has displayed a signal instance, since the captain's decease, of the affection and esteem in which he holds his memory. At his estate in Buckinghamshire, Sir Hugh hath constructed a small building, on which he has erected a pillar, containing the fine character of our great navigator, that is given at the end of the introduction to The Last Voyage, and the principal part of which has been inserted in the present work. This character was drawn up by a most respectable gentleman, who has long been at the head of the naval profession, the Honorable Admiral Forbes, Admiral of the Fleet, and General of Marines, to whom Captain Cook was only known by his eminent merit and his extraordinary actions. Amidst the numerous testimonies of regard that have been paid to Captain Cook's merits and memory, the important object of providing for his family hath not been forgotten. Soon after the intelligence arrived of his unfortunate decease, this matter was taken up by the Lords of the Admiralty, with a zeal and an effect, which the following authentic document will fully display, at the Court at St. James, the 2nd of February, 1780. Apostrophe LS, present, the King's Most Excellent Majesty in Council. Whereas there was this day read, at the board, a memorial from the Right Honorable the Lords Commissioners of the Admiralty, dated the 27th of last month, in the words following, viz. Having received an authentic account of the death of that great navigator, Captain James Cook, who has had the honor of being employed by Your Majesty, in three different voyages, for the discovery of unknown countries, in the most distant parts of the globe, we think it our duty humbly, to represent to Your Majesty, that this meritorious officer, after having received from Your Majesty's gracious benevolence, as a reward for his public services in two successful circumnavigations, a comfortable and honorable retreat, where he might have lived many years to benefit his family, he voluntarily relinquished that ease and emolument, to undertake another of these voyages of discovery, in which the life of a commander, who does his duty, must always be particularly exposed, and in which, in the execution of that duty, he fell, leaving his family, whom his public spirit had led him to abandon, as a legacy to his country. We do therefore humbly propose, that Your Majesty will be graciously pleased to order a pension of £200 a year, to be settled on the widow, and £25 a year upon each of the three sons of the said Captain James Cook, and that the same be placed on the ordinary estimate of the Navy. His Majesty, taking the said memorial into his royal consideration, was pleased, with the advice of his Privy Council, to order, as it is hereby ordered, that a pension of £200 a year be settled on the widow, and £25 a year upon each of the three sons of the said Captain James Cook, and that the same be placed on the ordinary estimate of His Majesty's Navy, and the Lords Commissioners of the Admiralty, are to give the necessary directions herein accordingly. W. Falconer. Apostrophe, the preceding memorial to the King, was signed by the Earl of Sandwich, Mr. Buller, the Earl of Lisburn, Mr. Penton, Lord Mulgrave, and Mr. Mann, and the several officers of the Board of Admiralty seconded the ardor of their superiors, by the speed and generosity with which His Majesty's royal grant to Captain Cook's widow and children passed through the usual forms. Another occasion was afterwards seized of conferring a substantial benefit on the captain's family. The charts and plates belonging to the voyage to the Pacific Ocean were provided at the expense of government, the consequence of which was that a large profit accrued from the sale of the publication. Of this profit, half was consigned, in trust, to Sir Hugh Palliser and Mr. Stevens, to be applied to the use of Mrs. Cook during her natural life, and afterwards to be divided between her children. Honor as well as emolument hath graciously been conferred by His Majesty upon the descendants of Captain Cook. On the 3rd of September, 1785, a coat of arms was granted to the family, of which a description will be given below. 19, footnote 19, azure, between the two polar stars, or, a sphere on the plane of the meridian, north pole elevated, circles of latitude for every 10 degrees, and of longitude for every 15, shewing the Pacific Ocean between 60 and 240 west, bounded on one side by America, on the other by Asia and New Holland, in memory of the discoveries made by him in that ocean, so very far beyond all former navigators. His track thereon is marked with red lines. And for crest, on a wreath of the colors, is an arm embowed, vested in the uniform of a captain of the Royal Navy. In the hand, is the Union Jack, on a staff proper. The arm is encircled by a wreath of palm and laurel. Our navigator had 6 children, James, Nathaniel, Elizabeth, Joseph, George, and Hugh. Of these, Joseph and George died soon after their birth, and Elizabeth in the 5th year of her age. James, the eldest son, who was born at St. Paul's, Shadwell, on the 13th of October, 1763, is now a lieutenant in His Majesty's Navy. In a letter, written by Admiral Sir Richard Hughes, in 1785, from Grenada, to Mrs. Cook, he is spoken of in terms of high approbation. Nathaniel, who was born on the 14th of December, 1764, at Mile End Old Town, was brought up likewise in the naval service, and was unfortunately lost on board His Majesty's ship Thunderer, Commodore Walsingham, in the hurricane which happened at Jamaica, on the 3rd of October, 1730. He is said to have been a most promising youth. Hugh, the youngest, was born on the 22nd of May, 1776, and was so called after the name of his father's great friend, Sir Hugh Palliser. It hath often been mentioned, in terms of no small regret, that a monument hath not yet been erected to the memory of Captain Cook, in Westminster Abbey. The wish and the hope of such a monument are hinted at in the close of Dr. Douglas's introduction to the government edition of The Last Voyage, and the same sentiment is expressed by the author of the eulogium, at the end of that introduction. Sir Hugh Palliser has also spoken to the like purpose, in a communication I received from him. It would certainly redound to the honor of the nation, to order a magnificent memorial of the abilities and services of our illustrious navigator, on which account a tribute of that kind may be regarded as a desirable thing. But a monument in Westminster Abbey would be of little consequence to the reputation of Captain Cook. His fame stands upon a wider base, and will survive the comparatively perishing materials of brass, or stone, or marble. The name of Cook will be held in honor, and recited with applause, so long as the records of human events shall continue in the earth, nor is it possible to say what may be the influence and rewards, which, in other worlds, shall be found to attend upon eminent examples of wisdom and of virtue. Appendix. After the death of Captain Cook, and the events immediately succeeding it, Captain Clerk, upon whom the command of the expedition had devolved, proceeded from Oahu and coasted several of the other islands of the group. The ships anchored at Atuai to procure water. In doing this our voyagers experienced some interruption from the natives, and a slight conflict took place, in which one of the islanders was wounded by a musket shot. They were here told that, at their preceding visit, they had left a disorder amongst the women, of which several persons of both sexes had died. And as there was not the slightest appearance of the disorder amongst the natives at the first arrival of the vessels, there is too much reason to believe that some of the crew were the authors of that irreparable mischief. But too, I was in a state of internal warfare. The quarrel had arisen about the goats Captain Cook had left at Aneheo the year before, the property of which was contested by two different chiefs. The goats, which had increased to the number of 6, and would probably in a few years have stocked all these islands, were destroyed in the contest. Our voyagers left the Sandwich Islands finally on the 15th of March, and stood to the southwest, in hopes of falling in with the island of Madupapapa, which they were told by the natives, lay in that direction, about 5 hours' sail from Tahora. But though the two vessels stretched asunder several miles, they did not discover it. It is possible it might have been passed in the night, as the islanders described it to be small, sandy, and almost even with the surface of the sea. The harbor of St. Peter and St. Paul, in Oatska Bay, was appointed for the next rendezvous of the two vessels, in case of separation. In the course of their navigation towards Kamchatka, they traversed that part of the northern Pacific, in which some islands and lands were laid down in the charts, such as the island of Riaya de Plata in de Lisle's chart, and the land said to have been seen by John da Gama, in a voyage from China to New Spain, first delineated in a chart published by Teixeira, a Portuguese geographer, in 1649. But though at sundry times they had various indications of land, they discovered none, and those islands and lands must therefore either be of trifling extent, or wholly imaginary. A leak, under the larboard bow of the Resolution, which had kept the people almost constantly at the pumps, ever since their leaving the Sandwich Islands, occasioned a great alarm on the 13th of April. The water, which had lodged in the coal hole, not finding a sufficient vent into the well, had forced up the platforms over it, and in a moment deluged the whole space between decks. The coals would very soon choke up a pump, and the number of bulky materials that were washed out of the gunner's storeroom, and which, by the ship's motion, were tossed violently from side to side, rendered it impracticable to bail the water out. No other method was therefore left than to cut a hole through the bulkhead that separated the coal hole from the forehold. As soon as the passage was made, the greatest part of the water was emptied into the well, but the leak was now so much increased that it was necessary to keep one half of the people constantly pumping and bailing till the noon of the 15th. On the 23rd, at 6 in the morning, on the fog clearing away, the land of Kamchatka appeared, in mountains covered with snow. The weather was most severe, the ship appeared to be a complete mass of ice, and the shrouds were so incrusted with it, as to measure in circumference more than double their usual size. The crew suffered very severely from the cold, particularly from having lately left the tropical climates, and, but for the foresight and care of their officers, would indeed have been in a deplorable state. It was natural to expect that their experience, during their voyage to the north the year before, would have made them sensible of the necessity of paying some attention to their clothing, as it was generally known in both ships that they were to make another voyage towards the pole. But, with the thoughtlessness of infants, upon their return to a warm climate, their fur jackets and the rest of their cold country clothes were kicked about the decks as things of no value. They were of course picked up by the officers, and being put into casks, were, in due season, restored to their owners. On the 25th, when off the entrance of Oatska Bay, the Resolution lost sight of the Discovery, and on the 28th entered the bay. The officers of the Resolution examined every corner of it with their glasses, in search of the town of St. Peter and St. Paul, which they had conceived to be a place of some strength and consideration. At length they discovered, on a narrow point of land, a few miserable log houses, and some conical huts raised on poles, amounting in all to about 30, which, from the situation, they were under the necessity of concluding to be Petropavlovska. However, apostrophe says Captain King, in justice to the generous and hospitable treatment we found here, I shall beg leave to anticipate the reader's curiosity by assuring him that our disappointment proved to be more of a laughable than a serious nature. For, in this wretched extremity of the earth, situated beyond everything that we conceive to be most barbarous and inhospitable, and, as it were, out of the very reach of civilization, barricadoed with ice, uncovered with summer snow, in a poor miserable port, far inferior to the meanest of our fishing towns, we met with feelings of humanity, joined to a greatness of mind, an elevation of sentiment, which would have done honor to any nation or climate. Apostrophe apostrophe, in the morning of the 29th, Captain, then Lieutenant King was sent on shore, and after experiencing much difficulty from the broken ice, that extended nearly half a mile, across which he was obliged to make the best of his way on foot, was received by the commander of the garrison at the head of his men consisting of about 30 soldiers. They had not seen the ship the preceding day, nor indeed that morning, till the boats were pretty near the ice. Much panic ensued. The garrison was put under arms, and two field pieces placed at the entrance of the commander's house. All, however, soon wore a friendly aspect, and nothing could exceed the kindness and hospitality of the officer, a sergeant, who commanded in the Ostrog, and at whose house they were entertained. He furnished Lieutenant King, who had fallen in between the disjointed ice, with a complete suit of clothes of his own. The dinner that was served up consisted of four courses, but the conversation, from the want of an interpreter, no other language being understood there but Russian and Kamchatdale, was confined to a few bows and other signs of mutual respect. The sergeant sent of an express to Bolsheretsk, where the governor of the province usually resided, and whence he had to look for orders what to do, as to the procurement of the supplies of provisions and naval stores, which our people wanted. On their return, a sledge drawn by five dogs, with a driver, was provided for each of the party. The sailors were highly delighted with this mode of conveyance, and what diverted them most was that the two boat hooks which they had brought had also a sledge to themselves. On the 1st of May, the Discovery entered the bay. On the day after, early in the morning, an answer was received from Bolsheretsk. The dispatches had been sent off on the 29th, about noon, by a sledge drawn by dogs, so that they were only a little more than 3 days and a half in performing a journey of 270 miles, Bolsheretsk being about 135 rules from St. Peter and St. Paul. As the whole stock of live cattle which the country about the bay could afford amounted only to 2 heifers, Captain Clerk found it necessary to send to Bolsheretsk, and Captain Gore and Lieutenant King were fixed on for the excursion. They proceeded by boats up the Oatska River, then across part of the country in sledges, and then down the Bolsherika in canoes. Major Bem, the governor of Kamchatka, received them, not only with the utmost politeness, but with the most engaging cordiality, and all the principal people of the town vied with each other who should shew the most civility to strangers from the other extremity of the globe. A list of the naval stores, the number of cattle, and the quantity of flour wanted by the navigators, was given to Major Bem, who insisted upon supplying all their wants, and when they desired to be made acquainted with the price of the articles with which they were to be supplied, and proposed that Captain Clerk should give bills to the amount on the victualling office in London, the Major positively refused, and whenever it was afterward urged, stopped them short by saying he was certain he could not oblige his mistress, the Empress, more than in giving every assistance in his power to her good friends and allies, the English, and that it would be a particular satisfaction to her to hear that, in so remote a part of the world, her dominions had afforded any relief to ships engaged in such services, that he could not therefore act so contrary to the character of his Empress as to accept of any bills, but that, To accommodate the matter, he would take a bare attestation of the particulars with which we might be furnished, and that this he would transmit to his court as a certificate of having performed his duty. The town of Bolsheretz consists of several rows of low buildings, barracks for the Russian soldiers and Cossacks, a good-looking church, and a courtroom, with a great number of Balagan's summer habitations, belonging to the Kamchatdales, at the end of the town. The inhabitants amount to between 500 and 600. It would exceed the bounds to which this sketch must necessarily be confined, to enumerate one half of the instances of civility and attention which Major Bem, his lady, the officers of the garrison, and the inhabitants of the town bestowed upon the English travelers. One generous present cannot, however, be passed over in silence, both because it consisted of the greatest part of their small store of the article, and because it called forth from the British seamen a corresponding generosity. Being informed of the privations the sailors had suffered from the want of tobacco, Major Bem sent 4 bags of it, weighing upwards of 100 pounds each, which he begged might be presented, in the name of himself and the garrison under his command, to our sailors. When the seamen were told of it, the crews of both ships desired, entirely of their own accord, that their grog might be stopped, and their allowance of spirits presented, on their part, to the garrison of Bolsheretsk, as they had reason to conclude that brandy was scarce in the country, and would be very acceptable, since the soldiers on shore had offered 4 rubles a bottle for it. When it is considered how much the sailors would feel from the stoppage of their allowance of grog, and that this offer would deprive them of it during the inclement season they had to expect on their ensuing expedition to the north, the sacrifice must be looked upon as generous and extraordinary, and that they might not suffer by it, Captain Clerk substituted, in the room of the very small quantity the Major could be prevailed on to accept, the same quantity of rum. When the party returned to Petropolowska, Major Bem accompanied them, and visited the ships. He had resigned the command of Kamchatka, and was in a short time to return to St. Petersburg. Our navigators therefore committed to his care dispatches for England, with the journals and charts of the voyage so far. They got about 20 head of cattle, about 9,000 weight of rye flour, and a variety of other provisions and refreshments here, especially fish, with which they were absolutely overpowered from every quarter, and, having completed their water, they weighed anchor on the 13th of June, and on the 16th cleared the bay. The volcano, situated to the north of the harbor, was in a state of eruption at the time. On the 5th of July, our navigators passed through Bering's Straits, having run along the Asiatic coast. They then stretched over to that of America, with a view of exploring it between the latitudes of 68 and 69. But in this attempt they were disappointed, being stopped, on the 7th, by a large and compact field of ice connected with the land. On the 9th, they had sailed nearly 40 leagues to the westward, along the edge of the ice, without seeing any opening, and had therefore no prospect of advancing farther north. Until the 27th, however, they continued to seek a passage, first on the American, and then on the Asiatic side, but were never able to penetrate farther north than 70-33, which was 5 leagues short of the point to which they had advanced the season before. At one time, in attempting to penetrate to the northwestward, the Discovery was in a very dangerous situation. She became so entangled by several large pieces of ice that her way was stopped, and immediately dropping bodily to leeward, she fell broadside foremost on the edge of a considerable body of ice, and having at the same time an open sea to windward, the surf caused her to strike violently upon it. This mass at length either so far moved or broke as to set them at liberty to make another trial to escape. But, before the ship gathered way enough to be under command, she again fell to leeward on another fragment, and the swell making it unsafe to lie to windward, and finding no chance of getting clear, they pushed into a small opening, furled their sails, and made fast with ice hooks. A change of wind, however, taking place in the afternoon, the ice began to separate, and, setting all their sails, they forced a passage through it. The vessel had rubbed off a great deal of the sheathing from her bows, and became very leaky from the strokes she received when she fell on the edge of the ice. In these high latitudes, our navigators killed several seahorses, and also two white bears. The flesh of the latter afforded a few excellent meals of fresh meat. It had indeed a strong fishy taste, but was in every respect superior to that of the seahorse, which nevertheless, the sailors were again persuaded, without much difficulty, to prefer to their salted provisions. Finding a farther advance to the northward, as well as a nearer approach to either continent, obstructed by a sea blocked up with ice, Captain Clerke at length determined to lose no more time in the pursuit of what seemed utterly unattainable, and to sail for Oatska Bay, to repair their damages, and before the winter should set in, to explore the coast of Japan on their way towards Europe. To the great joy, therefore, of every individual on board both ships, they turned their faces towards home, and the delight and satisfaction they experienced on the occasion, notwithstanding the tedious voyage they had to make, and the immense distance they had to run, were as freely entertained, and perhaps as fully enjoyed, as if they had been already in sight of the Land's End. On the 31st, they repassed Bering Straits. With respect to the practicability of a northeast-northwest passage into the Pacific Ocean, through those straits, from the result of their attempts it appears that the north of the straits is clearer of ice in August than in July, and perhaps in a part of September it may be still more free. But, after the equinox, the days shorten so fast that no farther thaw can be expected, and so great an effect cannot rationally be allowed to the warm weather in the first half of September, as to imagine it capable of dispersing the ice from the most northern parts of the American coast. But admitting this to be possible, it would be madness to attempt to run from the icy cape to the known parts of Baffin's Bay, a distance of 420 leagues, in so short a time as that passage can be supposed to remain open. Upon the Asiatic side, there appears still less probability of success, for, though Deshnev, a Russian navigator, about a century and a half ago, passed round the northeast point of Asia, no voyager has yet been able to double Cape Timura beyond the mouth of the Lena, which stretches to the 78th of latitude. Captain Clerke's health now rapidly declined, and, on the 17th of August he was no longer able to get out of his bed. On the 21st, they made the coast of Kamchatka, and on the following day, at 9 in the morning, Captain Clerke died. 19 His disease was a consumption, which had evidently commenced before he left England, and of which he had lingered during the whole voyage. Footnote 19, Captain Clerke departed this life in the 38th year of his age. He was brought up to the Navy from his earliest youth, and had been in several actions during the war which began in 1756. In the action between the Bellona and the Kaurajou, being stationed in the mizen top, he was carried overboard with the mast, but was taken up without having received any hurt. He was a midshipman in the Dolphin, commanded by Captain Byron, in her voyage round the world, after which he served on the American station. In 1768, he made his second voyage round the world, in the Endeavour, as master's mate, and, in consequence of the death of Mr. Hicks, which happened on the 23rd of May, 1771, he returned home a lieutenant. His third circumnavigation of the globe was in the Resolution, of which he was appointed the second lieutenant, and he continued in that situation till his return in 1775, soon after which he was promoted to the rank of master and commander. In what capacity he sailed with Captain Cook in this last expedition need not be added. The consumption, of which Captain Clerke died, had evidently commenced before he left England, and he lingered under it during the whole voyage. Though his very gradual decay had long made him a melancholy object to his friends, nevertheless, they derived some consolation from the equanimity with which he bore his disorder, from the constant flow of good spirits maintained by him to his latest hour, and from his submitting to his fate with cheerful resignation. It was, however, impossible, apostrophe says Mr. King, not to feel a more than common degree of compassion for a person whose life had been a continued scene of those difficulties and hardships to which a seaman's occupation is subject, and under which he at last sunk. Apostrophe apostrophe, King's Voyage, p. 280, 281. On the 24th, the vessels anchored in the harbor of St. Peter and St. Paul, where the gentlemen on board were received by their Russian friends with the same cordiality as before. Captain Gore, upon whom the command of the expedition now devolved, removed himself to the Resolution, and appointed Mr. King to the command of the Discovery. He sent off an express to the commander at Bolsheretsk, in which he requested to have 16 head of black cattle. The eruption of the volcano, which had taken place at the time of the late departure of the vessels from Oatsk, had done no damage, notwithstanding stones had fallen at the Ostrog of the size of a goose's egg. Attempts were now made to repair, as far as was practicable, the damage the Discovery had sustained in the ice, and in removing the sheathing, 8 feet of a plank in the whale were found to be so very rotten as to make it necessary to shift it. The carpenters were sent on shore in search of a tree large enough for the purpose. Luckily they found a birch, which was the only one of sufficient size in the whole neighborhood of the bay. The crews were employed in various necessary occupations, amongst which, 4 men were set apart to haul the seine for salmon, which were caught in great abundance, and of excellent quality. After supplying the immediate wants of both ships, they salted down near a hogshead a day. The seahorse blubber, with which they had stored themselves during their expedition to the north, was boiled down for oil, now become a necessary article, their candles having been long since all used. The body of Captain Clerk was interred on Sunday the 29th, with all the solemnity and honors they could bestow, under a tree, in the valley on the north side of the harbor, a spot which the priest of Paratownia said would be, as near as he could guess, in the center of the new church intended to be erected. On the 3rd of September, arrived an ensign from Bolsheretsk, with a letter from Captain Shmalov, the present commander, who promised the cattle required, and that he would himself pay them a visit immediately on the arrival of a sloop, which was daily expected from Okhotsk. On the morning of the 10th, a Russian galleot, from Okhotsk, was towed into the harbor. As he had been 35 days on her passage, and had been seen from the lighthouse a fortnight before, beating up towards the mouth of the bay. There were 50 soldiers in her, with their wives and children, and several other passengers. A sub-lieutenant, who came in her, now took the command of the garrison, and from some cause or other, which the English could not learn, their old friend, the sergeant, the late commander of the place, fell into disgrace, and was no longer suffered to sit down in the company of his own officers. From the galleot, our navigators got a small quantity of pitch, tar, cordage, and twine, and 140 skins of flour, containing 13,782 pounds. English. The hospitan Ivaskin from Verchny had been desired by Mayor Bem to attend the English officers on their return to the harbor, in order to be their interpreter. He now came. He was an exile, and was of a considerable family in Russia. His father was a general, and he himself, after having received his education partly in France and partly in Germany, had been page to the Empress Elizabeth, and ensign in her guards. At the age of 16, he was noted, had his nose slit, and was banished, first to Siberia, and afterward to Kamchatka, where he had lived 31 years. He bore in his whole figure the strongest marks of old age, though he had scarcely reached his 54th year. No one there knew the cause of his banishment, but they took it for granted that it must have been for something very atrocious, as two or three of the commanders of Kamchatka had in vain endeavored to get him recalled since the present empress's reign. For the first 20 years he had not tasted bread, nor been allowed subsistence of any kind, but had lived during that period among the Kamchatdales, on what his own activity and toil in the chase could procure him. Afterward, he had a small pension granted him. This Major Bem, by his intercession, had caused to be increased to 100 roubles a year, which is the common pay of an ensign in all parts of the Empress's dominions, except in this province, where the pay of all the officers is double. This gentleman joined Captains Gore and King on a bear hunting party on the 17th, for 2 days, in which, first from the party being too large, and the unavoidable noise that was the consequence of it, and next, from the unfavorable weather after they separated, they were wholly unsuccessful. On the 22nd, the anniversary of His Majesty's coronation, and when they were sitting down to as handsome a feast as their situation would admit of, in honor of the day, the arrival of Captain Schmalloff from Bolsheretsk was announced. He partook of their festivities, and set off on his return on the 25th. Before his departure, he reinstated the sergeant in the command of the place, and took with him the sub-lieutenant who had superseded him. Captain King accompanied Captain Schmalloff to the entrance of Oatska River, and on Sunday, the 26th, attended him to church at Peritonia. The church is of wood, and by far the best building in the country round about the bay. It is ornamented by many paintings, particularly with two pictures of St. Peter and St. Paul, presented by Bering, and which, in the real richness of their drapery, would carry off the prize from the first of European performances. For all the principal parts of it are made of thick plates of solid silver, fastened to the canvas, and fashioned into the various foldings of the robes. The next day another hunting party was set on foot, under the direction of the clerk of the parish, who was a celebrated bear hunter. The produce was a female bear, beyond the common size, which they shot in the water, and found dead the next morning in the place to which as he had been watched. The mode of hunting these animals by the natives is as follows: when they come to the ground frequented by the bears, their first step is to look for their tracks. These are found in the greatest numbers leading from the woods down to the lakes, and among the long sedgy grass, and breaks by the edge of the water. The place of ambuscade being determined on, the hunters next fix in the ground the crutches upon which their firelocks are made to rest, pointing them in the direction they mean to shoot. This done, they kneel, or lie down, and, with their bare spears by their side, wait for the game. These precautions, which are chiefly taken in order to make sure of their mark, are, on several accounts, highly expedient. For, in the first place, ammunition is so dear in Kamchatka that the price of a bear will not purchase more of it than is sufficient to load a musket 4 or 5 times. And, what is more material, if the bear be not rendered incapable of pursuit by the first shot, the consequences are often fatal. He immediately makes towards the place whence the noise and smoke issue, and attacks his adversaries with great fury. It is impossible for them to reload, as the animal is seldom at more than 12 or 15 yards distance when he is fired at, so that, if he does not fall, they immediately put themselves in a posture to receive him upon their spears, and their safety greatly depends on their giving him a mortal stab as he first comes upon them. If he parries the thrust which bears, by the extraordinary strength and agility of their paws, are often enabled to do, and thereby breaks in upon his adversaries, the conflict becomes very unequal, and it is well if the life of one of the party alone suffice to pay the forfeit. On the 1st of October, the cattle arrived from Verchny, and the 3rd, being the name day of the Empress, Captain Gore invited the priest of Peritonia, Ivaskin, and the sergeant, to dinner, and an entertainment was also provided for the inferior officers of the garrison, for the Toyans of Peritonia and Petropoloska, and for the better sort of the Kamchatdale inhabitants. The rest of the natives of every description were invited to partake with the ship's companies, who had a pound of good fat beef served up to each man, and what remained of their spirits was made into grog and divided amongst them. On the 5th, our navigators received from Bolsheretsk a fresh present of tea, sugar, and tobacco. They were ready for sea, but the weather prevented them from leaving the bay till the 9th. Just before they weighed anchor, the drummer of the marines belonging to the Discovery deserted, having been last seen with a Kamchatdale woman, to whom his messmates knew he had been much attached, and who had often been observed persuading him to stay behind. This man had been long useless to them, from a swelling in his knee, which rendered him lame, but this made them the more unwilling to leave him behind, to become a burden both to the Russians and himself. Some of the sailors were therefore sent to a well-known haunt of his in the neighborhood, where they found him and his woman. On the return of the party with the deserter, the vessels weighed, and came out of the bay. Oatska Bay has within its mouth a noble basin of 25 miles in circuit, with the capacious harbors of Tarenska to the west, Rakovina to the east, and the small one of St. Peter and St. Paul to the north. The last mentioned is a most convenient little harbor. It will hold with ease half a dozen ships moored head and stern, and is fit for giving them any kind of repairs. The south side is formed by a low sandy neck, exceedingly narrow, on which the Ostrog is built. The deepest water within is 7 fathoms, and in every part over a muddy bottom. There is a watering place at the head of the harbor. The commerce of this country, as far as regards the exports, is entirely confined to furs and carried on by a company of merchants instituted by the Empress. Besides these, there are many inferior traders, particularly Cossacks, scattered through the country. Formerly this commerce was altogether carried on by barter, but lately every article is bought and sold for ready money only. Our sailors brought a great number of furs with them from the coast of America, and were both astonished and delighted with the quantity of silver the merchants paid down for them. But on finding neither gin shops to resort to, nor tobacco, nor anything else that they cared for, to be at for money, the roubles soon became troublesome companions, and often to be seen kicked about the decks. The articles of importation are principally European. Several likewise come from Siberia, Bacharia, the Kalmyks, and China. They consist of coarse woolen and linen cloths, yarn stockings, bonnets and gloves, thin Persian silks, cottons and nankeens, handkerchiefs, brass and copper pans, iron stoves, files, guns, powder and shot, hardware, looking glasses, flour, sugar, tanned hides, and see though the merchants have a large profit upon these important goods, they have still a larger upon the furs of Kiachta, upon the frontiers of China, which is the great market for them. The best sea otter skins sell generally in Kamchatka for about 30 roubles each. The Chinese merchant at Kiachta purchases them at more than double that price, and sells them again at Pekin at a great advance, whence a farther profitable trade is made with some of them to Japan. If, therefore, a skin is worth 30 roubles in Kamchatka, to be transported first to Okhotsk, thence by land to Kiachta, a distance of 1364 miles, thence to Pekin, 760 miles more, and after that to be conveyed to Japan, what a prodigiously advantageous trade might be carried on direct to Japan, which is about a fortnight or 3 weeks' sail from Kamchatka. It was now resolved, in consequence of the latitude given by the instructions of the Board of Admiralty, to run along the Kurils, and to survey the eastern coasts of the Japanese islands, previous to returning homewards. And Captain Gore gave orders for Macau to be the place of rendezvous in case of separation. They coasted along the peninsula of Kamchatka with variable weather, and on the 12th, at 6 in the afternoon, they saw, from the masthead, Cape Lepatka, the southernmost extremity of the peninsula. This point of land, which is a low flat cape, formed a marked object in the geography of the eastern coast of Asia, and by an accurate observation and several good angles, they determined its precise situation to be in latitude 51.0 and longitude 156.45. At the same time they saw two the first of the Kuril Islands, called Shumsha, and on the next day they saw the second, Paramauser. The latter is the largest of the Kuril subject to Russia, but the gale increasing from the west, they were never able to approach it nearer than to observe its general aspect, which was very high land, almost entirely covered with snow, and to ascertain its situation, which was found to be 10 west longitude from Lopatka, and its latitude 50.46 at the north, and 49.58 at the south end. On the 14th and 15th, the wind blowing steadily from the westward, they were obliged to stand to the southward, and were consequently hindered from seeing any more of the Kuril Islands. In the situation they then found themselves, they were almost surrounded by the supposed discoveries of former navigators. To the southward and southwest were placed, in the French charts, a group of five islands, called the Three Sisters, Zeleny, and Zunasher. They were about 10 leagues, according to the same maps, to the westward of the land of Dagama, and as the company's land, Staten Island, and the famous land of Jesso, were also supposed to lie nearly in the same direction, this course was deemed to deserve the preference, and they hauled round to the westward, the wind having shifted to the north. A succession of gales, however, and now and then a storm, that reduced them to their courses, drove them too much to the southward, prevented them from falling in even with the southernmost of the Kuril Islands, and obliged them at last to give up all further thoughts of discovery to the north of Japan. On the 22nd, the gale having abated, they let out the reefs of the topsails, and made more sail. At noon they were in latitude 40.58, and longitude 148.17, and two small land birds being taken on board, plainly indicated they could not be any great distance from the land. They therefore hauled up to the west-northwest, in which direction the southernmost island seen by Spanberg, and said to be inhabited by hairy men, lay at the distance of about 50 leagues. They saw several other signs of land. But, on the 24th, the wind shifted to the north, and blew a fresh gale, so that they finally gave up all further search for islands to the north of Japan, and shaped their course west-southwest, for the north part of that island. On the 26th, at daybreak, they descried high land to the westward, which proved to be Japan. The country consisted of a double range of mountains. It abounded with wood, and had a pleasing variety of hills and dales. They saw the smoke of several towns, and many houses near the shore, in pleasant and cultivated situations. They stood off and on, according as the weather permitted them, till the 28th in the afternoon, when they lost sight of the land, and from its breaking off so suddenly, they conjectured that what they had before seen was a cluster of islands, lying off the mainland of Japan. The next day they saw land again, 11 leagues to the southward. The coast appeared straight and unbroken. Towards the sea it was low, but rose gradually into hills of a moderate height, whose tops were tolerably even, and covered with wood. At 9 o'clock, the wind shifting to the southward, they tacked and stood off to the east, and soon after they saw a vessel close in with the land, standing along shore to the northward, and another in the offing, coming down before the wind. Objects of any kind, belonging to a country, so famous and yet so little known, excited a general curiosity, and every soul on board, was upon deck in an instant, to gaze at them. The vessel to windward passed ahead of them at the distance of about 1/2 mile. It would have been easy to have spoken with her, but perceiving, by her maneuvers, that she was much frightened, Captain Gore was not willing to augment her terrors, and thinking that they should have many better opportunities of communicating with the Japanese, suffered her to go off without interruption. There appeared to be about 6 men on board, and, according to the best conjectures that could be formed, the vessel was about 40 tons burden. As he had but one mast, on which was hoisted a square sail, extended by a yard aloft, the braces of which worked forward. Halfway down the sail, came 3 pieces of black cloth, at equal distances from each other. The vessel was higher at each end than in the midship, and from her appearance and form she did not appear to be able to sail otherwise than large. Soon after the wind increased so much, that our navigators were reduced to their courses, and the sea ran as high as anyone on board ever remembered to have seen it. If the Japanese vessels are, as Kempfer describes them, open in the stern, it would not have been possible for those they saw to have survived the fury of the storm. But as the appearance of the weather, all the preceding part of the day, foretold its coming, and one of the sloops had, notwithstanding, stood far out to sea, it was concluded they were perfectly capable of bearing a gale of wind. Our navigators were blown off the land by this gale, but on the 30th they saw it again, at the distance of about 15 leagues, appearing in detached parts, but it could not be determined whether they were small islands, or parts of Japan. On the 1st of November, they saw a number of Japanese vessels close in with the land, several seemingly engaged in fishing, and others standing along shore. They discovered to the westward a remarkably high mountain, with a round top, rising far inland. As this was the most remarkable hill on the coast, they wished to have settled its situation exactly. But only having had a single view, they were obliged to be contented with such accuracy as their circumstances would allow. Its latitude was reckoned to be 35-20, and its longitude 140-26. As the Dutch charts made the coast of Japan extend about 10 leagues to the southwest of White Paint, supposed to be the southernmost land then in sight, our navigators stood off to the eastward, to weather the point. At midnight they again tacked, expecting to fall in with the land to the southward, but were surprised to find, in the morning, that during 8 hours, in which they supposed they had made a course of 9 leagues to the southwest, they had in reality been carried 8 leagues in a direction diametrically opposite. Whence they calculated that the current had set to the northeast by north, at the rate of at least 5 miles an hour. On the 3rd of November, they were again blown off the land by a heavy gale, and found themselves upwards of 50 leagues off, which circumstances, together with the extraordinary effect of the currents they had experienced, the late season of the year, the unsettled state of the weather, and the little likelihood of any change for the better, made Captain Gore resolve to leave Japan altogether, and proceed in the voyage for China. On the 4th and 5th, our navigators, continuing their course to the southeast, passed great quantities of pumice stone. These stones appeared to have been thrown into the sea by eruptions of various dates, as many of them were covered with barnacles, and others quite bare. On the 13th, they had a most violent gale from the northward. In the morning of the 13th, the wind, shifting to the northwest, brought with it fair weather. But, though they were, at that time, nearly in the situation given to the island of San Juan, they saw no appearance of land. They continued to pass much pumice stone. Indeed, the prodigious quantities of that substance which floated in the sea, between Japan and the Bashi Islands, seemed to indicate that some great volcanic convulsion must have happened in that part of the Pacific Ocean. On the 14th, they discovered 2 islands, and on the next day a 3rd. But Captain Gore, finding that a boat could not land without some danger from the great surf that broke on the shore, kept on his course to the westward. The middle island is about 5 miles long. The south point is a high barren hill, presenting an evident volcanic crater. The earth, rock, or sand, for it was not easy to distinguish, of which its surface was composed, exhibited various colors, and a considerable part was conjectured to be sulfur, and some of the officers on board the Resolution thought they saw steams rising from the top of the hill. From these circumstances, Captain Gore gave it the name of Sulphur Island. A long narrow neck of land connects the hill with the south end of the island, which spreads out into a circumference of 3 or 4 leagues, and is of moderate height. The north and south islands appeared to be single mountains of a considerable height. Sulphur Island is in the latitude 2448, longitude 14112. The north island in latitude 2514, longitude 14110, and the south island in latitude 2422, and longitude 14120. Hence our navigators proceeded for the Bashi Islands, hoping to procure them such a supply of refreshment as would help to shorten their stay at Macau. But Captain Gore, being guided by the opinions of Commodore and Captain Wallace, as to the situation of these islands, which differ materially from Dampier's, they were foiled in their endeavors to find them, although, in the daytime, the ships spread 2 or 3 leagues from each other, and in the night, when under an easy sail. On the 27th, being in longitude 118.30, and having got to the westward of the Bashis, according to Mr. Byron's account, our navigators hauled their wind to the northwest, hoping to weather the Prada Shoals, but at 4, in the morning of the 28th, the breakers were close under their lee. At daylight they saw the island of Prada, and finding they could not weather the shoal, ran to leeward of it. As they passed the south side, they saw 2 remarkable patches on the edge of the breakers, that looked like wrecks. On the southwest side of the reef, and near the south end of the island, they thought they saw openings in the reefs which promised safe anchorage. In the forenoon of the 29th, they passed several Chinese fishing boats, and the sea was covered with wrecks of boats that had been lost, as they conjectured, in the late boisterous weather. They were in latitude 22.1, having run 110 miles since the preceding noon. On the 30th, they ran along the Lima Islands, and got a Chinese pilot on board. In obedience to the instruction given to Captain Cook by the Admiralty, the captains now required of the officers and men of both ships to give up their journals, and what other papers they had to their possession relative to the voyage, which was cheerfully complied with. And at 9 o'clock in the evening of the following day, they anchored 3 leagues from Macau. Here, upon sending on shore, to negotiate for supplies of provisions, and see they first received intelligence of the occurrences in Europe, during the protracted period of their absence. On the 4th of December, they stood into the Taipa, and moored with the stream anchor and cable to the westward. Captain King was sent up to Canton, to expedite the supplies that were wanted, and experienced every possible assistance from the supercargoes and gentlemen of the company's factory there. The purchase of the provisions and store wanted was completed on the 26th, and the whole stock was sent down on the following day by a vessel which Captain Gore had engaged for the purpose. 20 sea otter skins were sold at Canton, by Captain King, for $800. At the ships a brisk trade was carried on in the same article, by both officers and seamen. The sea otter skins every day rose in value, and a few prime skins, which were clean and well preserved, were sold for $120 each. The whole amount of the value, in specie and goods, that was got for the furs in both ships, did not fall short of £2,000, and it was generally supposed that at least 2/3 of the quantity originally obtained from the Americans were spoiled or worn out, or had been given away, or sold at Kamchatka. In consequence hereof, the rage with which the seamen were possessed to return to Cook River, and buy another cargo of skins to make their fortunes, was, at one time, not far short of mutiny. The numerous voyages that have since been undertaken for the prosecution of the trade here suggested, have rendered it familiar to the merchants both of Britain and of America, and, though it has not latterly been productive of advantages equal to those which were realized by the first adventurers, is still a branch of commerce that is successfully pursued. The barter which had been carrying on with the Chinese for their sea otter skins, produced a very whimsical change in the dress of the crews. On their arrival in the Taipa, nothing could exceed the ragged appearance both of the younger officers and seamen. Almost the whole of their original stock of European clothes having been long worn out, or patched up with skins, or the various manufactures they had met with in the course of their discoveries. These were now again mixed and eked out with the gaudiest silks and cottons of China. On the 11th of January, two seamen belonging to the Resolution ran off with a six-oared cutter, and were never after heard of. It was supposed that they had been seduced by the prevailing notion of making a fortune by returning to the Fur Islands. On account of the war between England and America, with France and Spain as her allies, of which they received intelligence at Canton, they put themselves in the best posture of defense, the Resolution mounting 16 guns, and the Discovery 10. They had reason, however, to believe, from the generosity of their enemies, that these precautions were superfluous, being informed that instructions had been found on board all the French ships of war captured in Europe, directing their commanders, in case of falling in with the ships that sailed under the command of Captain Cook, to suffer them to proceed without molestation. And the same orders were also said to have been given by the American Congress to the vessels employed in their service. In return for these liberal concessions, Captain Gore resolved to refrain from availing himself of any opportunities of capture, and to preserve throughout the remainder of the voyage the strictest neutrality. On the 12th of January, 1780, our navigators got under sail from Macau. On the 19th, they saw Pulo Zapata, and on the 20th, descried Pulo Condor, and anchored in the harbor at the southwest end of the island. The town is situated at the east end, and here they procured 8 buffaloes, with other refreshments. From the untractableness and prodigious strength of the buffaloes, it was both a tedious and difficult operation to get them on board. The method of conducting them was by passing ropes through their nostrils and round their horns. But, having been once enraged at the sight of our men, they became so furious that they sometimes broke the trees to which they were often under the necessity of being tied. Sometimes they tore asunder the cartilage of the nostril through which the ropes ran, and got loose. On these occasions, all the exertions of the men to recover them would have been ineffectual, without the assistance of some young boys, whom these animals would permit to approach them, and by whose little management their rage was soon appeased. A circumstance respecting these animals, which was thought no less singular than their gentleness toward, and, as it should seem, affection for, little children, was, that they had not been 24 hours on board, before they became the tamest of all creatures. Captain King kept two of them, a male and a female, for a considerable time, which became great favorites with the sailors, and thinking that a breed of animals of such strength and size, some of them weighing when dressed 700 pounds, would be a valuable acquisition, intended to have brought them with him to England, but his intention was frustrated by an incurable hurt which one of them received at sea. Our navigators remained here till the 28th of January, when they unmoored and proceeded on their homeward voyage, passing through the Straits of Bania and of Sunda, without any occurrence worthy of particular remark. They saw two or three Dutch ships in the Straits of Sunda. They watered at Prince's Island at the entrance of the Straits, and got a supply of fowls and turtle there. From the time of their entering the Straits of Bania, they began to experience the powerful effects of the pestilential climate, and malignant putrid fevers, with obstinate coughs and dysenteries, prevailed amongst the crews, happily, however, without one fatal termination. On the 18th of February they left the Straits of Sunda. In the night between the 25th and 26th, they experienced a most violent storm, during which almost every sail they had bent was split to rags, and the next day they were obliged to bend their last suit of sails, and to knot and splice the rigging, their cordage being all expended. On the 7th of April they saw the land of Africa, and on the 9th, they fell in with an English East India packet that had left Table Bay 3 days before. On the evening of the 12th, they dropped anchor in False Bay, and the next morning stood in Two Simons Bay. Having completed their victualling, and furnished themselves with the necessary supply of naval stores, our navigators sailed out of the bay on the 9th of May. On the 12th of June, they passed the equator for the fourth time during the voyage. On the 12th of August they made the western coast of Ireland, and, after a fruitless attempt to put into Port Galway, they were obliged, by strong southerly winds, to steer to the northward. And, on the 26th of August, both ships came to an anchor in Stromness, in the Orkneys, whence Captain King was dispatched by Captain Gore, to acquaint the Board of Admiralty with their arrival. On the 1st of October, the ships arrived safe at the Nore, after an absence of 4 years, 2 months, and 22 days. The Morai. An Ode. By Miss Helen Maria Williams. Fair Atahiite, fondly blessed by him, who long was doomed to brave the fury of the polar wave that fiercely mounts the frozen rock where the harsh seabird rears her nest and learns the raging surge to mock there, night that loves eternal storm. Deep and lengthened darkness throws, and untried danger's doubtful form its half-seen horror shews, while nature, with a look so wild, leans on the cliffs in chaos piled, that here, the awed, astonished mind forgets, in that o'erwhelming hour, when her rude hands the storms unbind, in all the madness of her power, that she who spreads the savage gloom, that she can dress in melting grace, in sport of summer's lavish bloom, the awful terrors of her face, and wear the sweet perennial smile that charms in the Tahiite isle. Yet, amid her fragrant bowers, where spring, whose dewy fingers strew o'er other lands some fleeting flowers, lives, in blossoms ever new, whence arose that shriek of pain, whence the tear that flows in vain. Death, thy unrelenting hand tears some transient human band eternity, rich plant that blows beneath a brighter, happier sky. Time is a fading branch that grows on thy pure stem and blooms to die. What art thou, death? Terrific shade, in unpierced gloom arrayed. Oft will daring fancy stray far in the central wastes, where night divides no cheering hour with day, and unnamed horrors meet her sight. There thy form she dimly sees, and round the shape unfinished throws all her frantic vision shoes, when numbing fears her spirit frees, but can mortal voice declare, if fancy paints thee as thou art? Thy aspect may a terror where her pencil never shall impart. The eye that once on thee shall gaze, no more its stiffened orb can raise. The lips that could thy power reveal, shall lasting silence instant seal. In vain the icy hand we fold, in vain the breast with tears we steep. The heart, that shared each pang, is cold, the vacant eye no more can weep. Yet from the shore, where Ganges rolls his wave beneath the torrid ray, to earth's chill verge, where o'er the poles fall the last beams of lingering day, forever sacred are the dead? Sweet fancy comes in sorrow's aid, and bids the mourner lightly tread, where the insensate clay is laid, bids partial gloom the sod invest by the moldering relics pressed, then lavish strews, with sad delight, water her consecrating power reveres of herb, her fruit, her flower, and fondly weaves the various rite. See, o'er a Tahiite's plain moves the long, funereal train, slow the pallid course they bear, oft they breathe the solemn prayer, where the ocean bathes the land, thrice, and thrice, with pious hand, the priest, when high the billow springs, from the wave unsullied, flings waters pure, that, sprinkled near, sanctify the hallowed bier, but never may one drop profane the relics with forbidden stain. Now around the funeral shrine, let in mystic mazes, twine garlands, where the plantain weaves with the palm's luxuriant leaves, and o'er each sacred knot is spread the plant devoted to the dead. Five pale moons with trembling light shall gaze upon the lengthened rite, shall see distracted beauty tear the tresses of her flowing hair, those shining locks, no longer dear, she wildly scatters o'er the bier, and careless gives the frequent wound that bathes in precious blood the ground. When along the western sky, day's reflected colors die, and twilight rules the doubtful hour, your slow pace night resumes her power. Mark the cloud, that lingers still darkly on the hanging hill. There the disembodied mind hears, upon the hollow wind, an unequal cadence thrown, sorrow's oft-repeated moan. Still some human passion sway the spirit laid immersed in clay. Still the faithful sigh is dear, still beloved the fruitless tear. Five waning moons, with wandering light, have passed the shadowy bound of night, and mingled their departing ray with the soft fires of early day. Let the last sad rite be paid grateful to the conscious shade. Let the priest, with pious care, now the wasted relics bear, where the moray's awful gloom shrouds the venerable tomb. Let the plantain lift its head, cherished emblem of the dead. Slow and solemn, o'er the grave, let the twisted plumage wave, symbol hallowed, and divine, of the god who guards the shrine. Hark! That shriek of strange despair never shall disturb the air. Never, never shall it rise, but for nature's broken ties. Bright crescent! That with lucid smiles gilds the moray's lofty pile, whose broad lines of shadow throw a gloomy horror far below. Witness, O recording moon! All the rites are duly done. Be the faithful tributor, the hovering spirit asks no more. Mortals, cease the pile to tread, leave, to silence, leave the dead. But where may she who loves to stray mid shadows of funereal gloom, and courts the sadness of the tomb, where may she seek the proud moray, whose dear memorial points the place, where fell the friend of human race? Ye lonely isles, on ocean's bound ye bloomed through time's long flight unknown, till Cook the untracted billow passed, till ye along the surges cast philanthropy's connecting zone, and spread her loveliest blessings round. Not like that murderous band he came, who stained with blood the new-found West, nor as, with unrelenting breast, from Britain's free enlightened land, her sons now seek Angola's strand, each tie most sacred to unbind, to load with chains a brother's frame, and plunge a dagger in the mind, mock the sharp anguish bleeding there of nature in her last despair. Great Cook! Ambition's lofty flame, so oft directed to destroy, let thee to circle with thy name, the smile of love, and hope, and joy. Those fires, that lent the dangerous blaze the devious comet trails afar, might form the pure benignant rays that gild the morning's gentle star sure, where the hero's ashes rest, the nation's late emergent from night still base with love's unwearied care that spot in lavish flowers is dressed, and fancy's dear inventive rite still paid with fond observance there. Ah no! Around his fatal grave, no lavish flowers were ever strewed, no votive gifts were ever laid, his blood a savage shore bedewed. His mangled limbs, one hasty prayer, one pious tear by friendship, paid, were cast upon the raging wave. Deep in the wild abyss he lies, far from the cherished scene of home, far, far from her whose faithful sighs a husband's trackless course pursue, whose tender fancy loves to roam with him o'er lands and oceans new, and gilds with hope's deluding form the gloomy pathway of the storm. Yet, Cook, immortal wreaths are thine. While Albion's grateful toil shall raise the marble tomb, the trophied bust, for ages faithful to its trust, while, eager to record thy praise, she bids the muse of history twine the chaplet of undying fame, until each polished land thy worth, the ruder natives of the earth, shall oft repeat thy honored name, while infants catch the frequent sound, and learn to list the oral tale, whose fond remembrance shall prevail till time has reached its destined bound. The end. End of the Project Gutenberg ebook of Narrative of the Voyages Round the World, performed by Captain James Cook, by A. Kippis. End of the Project Gutenberg ebook Voyage of Captain James Cook. This file should be named 7VCJC10. TTXT or 7VCJC10. Zip corrected editions of our ebooks, get a new number, 7VCJC11. TTXT versions based on separate sources get new letter, 7VCJC10ATTXT, produced by Stan Goodman. CAM Venezuela and the online distributed proofreading team, Project Gutenberg e-books are often created from several printed editions, all of which are confirmed as public domain in the U.S., unless a copyright notice is included. Thus, we usually do not keep e-books in compliance with any particular paper edition. We are now trying to release all our e-books 1 year in advance of the official release dates, leaving time for better editing. Please be encouraged to tell us about any error or corrections, even years after the official publication date. Please note neither this listing nor its contents are final till midnight of the last day of the month of any such announcement. The official release date of all Project Gutenberg e-books is at midnight, Central Time, of the last day of the stated month. A preliminary version may often be posted for suggestion, comment and editing by those who wish to do so. Most people started our websites at http://gutenberg.net or http://promo.net page. These websites include award-winning information about Project Gutenberg, including how to donate, how to help produce our new e-books, and how to subscribe to our email newsletter free. Those of you who want to download any ebook before announcement can get to them as follows, and just download by date. This is also a good way to get them instantly upon announcement, as the indexes our catalogers produce obviously take a while after an announcement goes out in the Project Gutenberg newsletter. http://iabiblio.org/pubdocsbooks/gutenberg/text03/etext02/01/09/98/97/96/95/94/93/92/92/91/90. Just search by the first five letters of the file name you want, as it appears in our newsletters. Information about Project Gutenberg, one page. We produce about $2 million for each hour we work. The time it takes us, a rather conservative estimate, is 50 hours to get any ebook selected, entered, proofread, edited, copyright searched and analyzed, the copyright letters written, etc. Our projected audience is 100 million readers. If the value per text is nominally estimated at $1, then we produce $2 million per hour in 2002 as we release over 100 new text files per month, 1240 more ebooks in 2001 for a total of 4,000 plus. We are already on our way to trying for 2,000 more ebooks in 2002. If they reach just 1-2% of the world's population, then the total will reach over half a trillion ebooks given away by year's end. The goal of Project Gutenberg is to give away 1 trillion ebooks. This is 10,000 titles each to 100 million readers, which is only about 4% of the present number of computer users. Here is the briefest record of our progress. Means estimated. Ebooks year month, 1971 July 10, 1991 January 100, 1994 January 1000, 1997 August 1500, 1998 October 2000, 1999 December 2500, 2000 December 3000, 2001 November 4000, 2001 October November 6000, 2002 December 9000, 2003 November 10,000, 2004 January, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation has been created to secure a future for Project Gutenberg into the next millennium. We need your donations more than ever. As of February 2002, contributions are being solicited from people and organizations in Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, Connecticut, Delaware, District of Columbia, Florida, Georgia, Hawaii, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, Louisiana, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, Nevada, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New Mexico, New York, North Carolina, Ohio, Oklahoma, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Vermont, Virginia, Washington, West Virginia, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. We have filed in all 50 states now, but these are the only ones that have responded. As the requirements for other states are met, additions to this list will be made, and fundraising will begin in the additional states. Please feel free to ask to check the status of your state. In answer to various questions we have received on this, we are constantly working on finishing the paperwork to legally request donations in all 50 states. If your state is not listed, and you would like to know if we have added it since the list you have, just ask. While we cannot solicit donations from people in states where we are not yet registered, we know of no prohibition against accepting donations from donors in these states who approach us with an offer to donate. International donations are accepted, but we don't know anything about how to make them tax deductible, or even if they can be made deductible, and don't have the staff to handle it, even if there are ways. Donations by check or money order may be sent to Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, PMB 113-1739 University Avenue, Oxford, MS 38655-4109. Contact us if you want to arrange for a wire transfer or payment method other than by check or money order. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation has been approved by the U.S. Internal Revenue Service as a 501(c)(3) organization with an employee identification number 64622154. Donations are tax deductible to the maximum extent permitted by law. As fundraising requirements for other states are met, additions to this list will be made, and fundraising will begin in the additional states. We need your donations more than ever. You can get up-to-date donation information online at http://www.ggutenberg.netdonation.html. If you can't reach Project Gutenberg, you can always email directly to michael.shart@pobox.com Prof. Hart will answer or forward your message. We would prefer to send you information by email. The legal small print, 3 pages, start the small print. For public domain ebooks start, why is this small print statement here? You know, lawyers. They tell us you might sue us if there is something wrong with your copy of this ebook, even if you got it for free from someone other than us, and even if what's wrong is not our fault. So, among other things, this small print statement disclaims most of our liability to you. It also tells you how you may distribute copies of this ebook if you want to. Before you use or read this ebook, by using or reading any part of this Project Gutenberg TM ebook, you indicate that you understand, agree to, and accept this small print statement. If you do not, you can receive a refund of the money, if any, you paid for this ebook by sending a request within 30 days of receiving it to the person you got it from. If you received this ebook on a physical medium, such as a disc, you must return it with your request. About Project Gutenberg TM ebooks. This Project Gutenberg TM ebook, like most Project Gutenberg TM ebooks, is a public domain work distributed by Professor Michael S. Hart through the Project Gutenberg Association, the Project, among other things. This means that no one owns a United States copyright honor for this work, so the Project and you can copy and distribute it in the United States without permission, and without paying copyright royalties. Special rules, set forth below, apply if you wish to copy and distribute this ebook under the Project Gutenberg trademark. Please do not use the Project Gutenberg trademark to market any commercial products without permission. To create these ebooks, the Project expends considerable efforts to identify, transcribe, and proofread public domain works. Despite these efforts, the Project's ebooks and any medium they may be on may contain defects. Among other things, defects may take the form of incomplete, inaccurate, or corrupt data, Transcription errors, a copyright or other intellectual property infringement, a defective or damaged disk or other e-book medium, a computer virus, or computer codes that damage or cannot be read by your equipment. Limited warranty. Disclaimer of damages, but for the item of replacement or refund described below, 1 Michael Hart and the Foundation and any other party you may receive this ebook from as a Project Gutenberg TM ebook, disclaims all liability to you for damages, costs and expenses, including legal fees, and 2 you have no remedies for negligence, or under strict liability, or for breach of warranty or contract, including but not limited to indirect, consequential, punitive or incidental damages, even if you give notice of the possibility of such damages. If you discover a defect in this ebook within 90 days of receiving it, you can receive a refund of the money, if any, you paid for it, by sending an explanatory note within that time to the person you received it from. If you received it on a physical medium, you must return it with your note, and such person may choose to alternatively give you a replacement copy. If you received it electronically, such person may choose to alternatively give you a second opportunity to receive it electronically. This ebook is otherwise provided to U.S.'s. No other warranties of any kind, express or implied, are made to you, as to the ebook or any medium it may be on, including but not limited to warranties of merchantability or fitness for a particular purpose. Some states do not allow disclaimers of implied warranties, or the exclusion or limitation of consequential damages, so the above disclaimers and exclusions may not apply to you, and you may have other legal rights. Indemnity. You will indemnify and hold Michael Hart, the foundation, and its trustees and agents, and any volunteers associated with the production and distribution of Project Gutenberg TM texts harmless from all liability, cost and expense, including legal fees, that arise directly or indirectly from any of the following, that you do or cause: 1. Distribution of this ebook; 2. Alteration, modification, or addition to the ebook; or 3. Any defect. Distribution under Project Gutenberg TM. You may distribute copies of this ebook electronically, or by disk, book or any other medium, if you either delete this small print, and all other references to Project Gutenberg, or 1. Only give exact copies of it. Among other things, this requires that you do not remove, alter or modify the ebook or this small print statement. You may, however, if you wish, distribute this ebook in machine-readable binary, compressed, markup, or proprietary form, including any form resulting from conversion by word processing or hypertext software, but only so long as either the ebook, when displayed, is clearly readable, and does not contain characters other than those intended by the author of the work, although tilde, tilde, asterisk, and underline characters may be used to convey punctuation intended by the author, and additional characters may be used to indicate hypertext links, or the ebook may be readily converted by the reader at no expense into plain ASCII, EBCDIC or equivalent form by the program that displays the ebook, as is the case, for instance, with most word processors, or you provide, or agree to also provide on request at no additional cost, fee or expense, a copy of the ebook in its original plain ASCII form or in EBCDIC or other equivalent proprietary form. To honor the ebook refund and replacement provisions of this small print statement. 3. Pay a trademark license fee to the foundation of 20% of the gross profits you derive, calculated using the method you already use to calculate your applicable taxes. If you don't derive profits, no royalty is due. Royalties are payable to Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation the 60 days following each date you prepare or were legally required to prepare your annual or equivalent periodic tax return. Please contact us beforehand to let us know your plans and to work out the details. What if you want to send money, even if you don't have to? Project Gutenberg is dedicated to increasing the number of public domain and licensed works that can be freely distributed in machine-readable form. The project gratefully accepts contributions of money, time, public domain materials, or royalty-free copyright licenses. Money should be paid to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. If you are interested in contributing scanning equipment or software or other items, please contact Michael Hart at hart@pobox.com. Portions of this ebook's header and trailer may be reprinted only when distributed free of all fees. Copyright C. 2001, 2002 by Michael S. Hart. Project Gutenberg is a trademark and may not be used in any sales of Project Gutenberg ebooks or other materials, be they hardware or software, or any other related product without express permission. End the small print. For public domain ebooks ver. 021102 and 7VCJC by Gutenberg Edition.